This episode, I'm joined by philosopher John Stuart to discuss his book, A History of Nihilism in the 19th Century, Confrontations with Nothingness. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, John Stuart, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Jim. It's a real pleasure to be here.
We are going to be discussing your recently released book, A History of Nihilism in the 19th Century, Confrontations with Nothingness. This was published by Cambridge University Press 2023. And this is a book which, as people can imagine from the title, is dealing with the philosophy of nihilism. But instead of looking at could we say common figures that we'd usually talk about when we talk about nihilism, primarily sort of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, even though, of course, they are referenced. This is looking at other figures who are really laying a foundation, even though it might not even be in name, of what then comes to be the more popular notion of nihilism, of that inherent meaninglessness. But before we jump in with the topic of nihilism in the 19th century. John, just tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is you do, and also the genesis of this book.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks so very much. I'm a philosopher. I'm trained in philosophy. I've worked for many years at different European universities. Right now, I am a researcher in the Institute of Philosophy at the Slovak Academy of Sciences here in beautiful Bratislava. I've been interested in this problem of nihilism for many years, and my main specialty in philosophy is in European philosophy of the 19th and 20th century. And in my readings, not just of philosophical texts, but also of literary texts and other genres from the 19th century, it struck me, I kept finding again and again certain nihilist ideas or discussions that I recognize from later discussions of nihilism in the 20th century. Everybody knows the nihilism of, say, the existentialists, and I was quite surprised to find this. And so I thought, well, where did this idea of nihilism start, actually, if there are so many of these, if people already in the 19th century are so interested in it? And you rightly mentioned Nietzsche and Schopenhauer. I think the names that come to mind immediately for most people when they hear about nihilism, and usually, like any history of nihilism, starts with those figures and then moves on to existentialism. And then I started to realize there's a lot more to it than just Nietzsche and Schopenhauer. And in fact, their own thought is to be understood in a broader context of discussion in the 19th century. And so I really wanted to try to present a different picture of that issue with the book and to try to see how the concept developed in ways that people hadn't perhaps thought so much about. That's the origin of the book and how I was originally motivated to do it.
Mm-hmm. And you're sort of somewhat has become not necessarily a joke, but a tongue-in-cheek joke on this podcast is the notion the person of Hegel, because I've never done a Hegel episode. And, uh-huh. One day I'll broach his work. Like, I keep tiptoeing around him. But you're primarily alongside this 19th and 20th century interest, you're a Hegel scholar. You've written much on Hegel. So is there a connection there as well? Do you see?
There is. Hegel was also engaged in a discussion about nihilism in his own time in the. One of his big opponents were the German Romanticists in his own day, people like Friedrich von Schlegel, and he criticized them for what we might regard as relativism and for their social criticism of society and the traditional values. And Hegel thought that the romantics weren't really so serious. It was sort of a fad, that they should take more seriously the traditional values and customs, and that there really are certain things that we can regard as truth and valuable in the modern world. And so Hegel was in an ongoing criticism with these people. He was quite sensitive to the issue, yes.
So we are, as many philosophers, I think, do, and I think, it's interesting, I was thinking, I'm terrible with dates, but I think so. I think the first usage of the word nihilism, as we understand it, is actually from Jacobi, who rarely gets a mention in philosophical discourse. But I guess just to ask the plain question, because even though many people think the definition is kind of clear, once you have the definition, it becomes very, very difficult to really discern what the definition of nihilism itself actually, how can that be? So I'll ask you, straight out, what is nihilism?
Yeah, you're quite right that the people use the term in different ways. They associate different things with it. When I told people that I was working on a book on nihilism, they immediately, okay, you're reading this or working on that. So no, that's not it at all, right? And I explained what I was doing. So that's the question that I felt like I had to address right at the beginning of the book, right in my introduction. Just okay, let's just get clear about what we're talking about, so we're all on the same page to start with. And I tried to identify different things that people associate with nihilism. So I try to claim that nihilism is not necessarily just one thing, but it's a cluster of different concepts which hang together in different ways. But then what I ended up concluding from that brief discussion was that the one thing that ties those different concepts together is basically this fundamental sense of there being a lack of meaning in human existence. The word nihilism, of course, it comes from the Latin word nihil, right? And it means nothing. So the belief in nothing. So you could translate that as being something like the belief in that there is no value in human existence. Everything is meaningless. And I think that fundamental concept is one that runs through the different motifs that people associate with nihilism, like with death and suffering or death of God, things like this. These are things which all seem to suggest there's no deeper meaning in the world.
Are you a nihilist?
No, I am not. I'm certainly not. I think actually it would be very difficult to be a consistent nihilist. That's what I like about some of these works that the works of fiction that I treat in the book, that they give us sketches of certain characters who we could regard as nihilists, but they're kind of crazy, goofy outsiders, that they're misfits, right? They end up in the insane asylum. I mean, if you really truly believe that your life was completely meaningless, had no value whatsoever, and you believe everybody else's life is that way as well, I think it would be extremely difficult to function in society. For me, I can only say, I mean, I don't know if I have a traditional value system or not, but I do believe that for me personally, there are certain things that I value, and there are certain things that I value more than others, and I make certain priorities in my life. I hope that these are rational and I can defend them. But it seemed to me, it would be, as John Paul tells us, it's really very difficult simply to say, I don't believe I'm worth anything. I don't believe my work is worth anything. I don't believe my life is worth anything. From a psychological point of view, extraordinarily difficult, really, to live with.
You mentioned the fictional aspect, and it's interesting that something I noticed with your book, that this question of can you actually be a nihilist, what would a nihilist really look like, has to become a sort of fragmented, fictional, other that you put somewhere else. Otherwise, as you say, you just completely wouldn't be able to, you wouldn't be able to do anything. You wouldn't even be able to exist. And it seems like we can almost maybe theoretically understand nihilism. We can see it. We can say, yeah, that may very well be the existence, but we can't internalize it. Otherwise we would lay down and, you know, I always wonder if that's, what happened to Nietzsche in that singular moment with the horse, right? Like it all came down in that one moment. And he just, it's finally too much.
Well, I see. Yeah, I think, anybody who claims to have certain nihilistic views probably has that moment at some point or another, right? But I like the way you phrase that. This theoretical approach to nihilism, if you say, all right, I ultimately don't believe in anything. I don't believe in God or the value of anything or the value in the universe. And you know, that's all fine from a theoretical point of view, but there's a real rub when it comes to practice. I mean, in fact, you have to live your life. Well, what are you going to do today, right? What are you going to do, next week? What are your plans in your life? Every step you take implies a certain value, right? That you're going to do this instead of that, right? And it's once you get into the daily mundane practicalities of life, you can't escape values. I mean, you're already socialized and have internalized so many of them. Sure, from a theoretical view, it's easy to step back and say that's all nonsense. But I mean, in practice, can you really do that consistently? I'm doubtful.
So there's two questions that arise from this, really, in relation to your book, which is, the fact of the subtitle, well, part of the title, 19th century. You know, this foundation, this beginning. So there's two questions. One is, why do you think it is that the 19th century is so important? This is where the clear sort of momentum, ironically, momentum of nothing, begins. But also, as we've already said, most famously, nihilism is known for, Sartre, the existentialists, later on in the 20th century. What's the difference? What does that transition look like? So why does it begin? What's happening for it to begin? And then what's the difference between these two, maybe not eras, but I think there is a note after reading your book, there's a very noticeable stylistic and temperamental approach to nihilism between the two eras, if we're to riskily segment them off.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. This was also something that I noted right at the beginning when I got interested in trying to trace this in the 19th century. Why is that so interesting or important? Because although the motifs that we're used to associating with nihilism were there, you see the tone is a little bit different and the historical experience of the two centuries is quite different. So I think most of us, when we associate nihilism with, as you mentioned, the existentialists, we tend to think very quickly of things like the world wars in the 20th century, the Holocaust, these horrors that have taken place at that time, from which existentialism arose. And so in those kind of a context, I mean, it makes sense that people would start to question, basic values or human nature or things like that, and end up in this struggle to try to justify a belief system. But in the 19th century, of course, none of that, nobody had those kind of experiences yet, but there was a different mechanism, I try to argue, that was taking place, and that was specifically the rapid development of the sciences during the Enlightenment. And so people might say, well, who cares? Why would that play any role? I try to point out that when prior to this period in the late 18th, early 19th century, most people in Europe were still living according to a traditional value system, a certain traditional Christian religion. And it was only with the rapid development of the sciences in the Enlightenment that this started to change, that this is the basis of our modern secular society, where those older beliefs came to be called into question by modern science. And this created a completely different, a radically different secular worldview that people struggled with at the time, as we went from a situation where human beings have a a special privileged status, right, where God exists, he ensures these absolute truths about things. Humans believe that they're immortal and they're somehow separate from nature, and that they occupy a very important role in the universe. And then as Enlightenment science gets going, all of these things start to fall, right? No, in fact, there's nothing special about the human beings. We are continuous with nature. There's nothing special about planet Earth, right? It's just one small planet orbiting, you know, one of a vast, vast number of stars, right? And the time dimension also changed. It wasn't, you know, so long ago, right? But people believe that the Earth began in like 6,000 BC, right? And then suddenly Enlightenment science comes along and says, no, we're talking on a completely different scale here, right? And so the understanding of the natural world, of course, was the occasion for people to rethink their own place in the universe. Okay, if that is all true, then who am I now? I have to rethink my own existence, my own role in the universe. And from that secular perspective, it's one that is diminished to being so tiny that, of course, the question of nihilism is going to arise. If I only exist for just like a blink in the history of the universe, and I'm going to be forgotten sooner or later, what's the point of my existence? I seem completely insignificant. And so this was the problem that the people in the 19th century that I try to treat in my book are all in one form or another trying to deal with.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, though, is it doesn't, you know, reading specifically, I think, of the quotations you find from Jean-Paul, which were, you know, I mean, his literary style is absolutely incredible. I'm jumping a little bit forward in the questions here, but what I was going to add there, just in that reference that I made to the tone, is so, you know, you have, I guess, famously, all these different revolutions which decenter us in the universe, then in, as you said, in time, and then eventually, I guess, to almost... It's quite strange, actually, to think about it now. To broach these two areas, you actually have psychoanalysis, right, decentering us from our own mind, and all these things saying that we're not special, we're insignificant, et cetera, et cetera. But what was interesting about what you bring out from all these thinkers, but the John Ball quote stood out because of his style, was a real, just this my own appreciation, a real playfulness in relation to this realization, a real... borderline enjoyment in the style. It's not as morbid. It's not as, whatever will we do? I don't know how you would describe this style, but that's what stood out to me was there's a sort of in the 19th century, it seems to be there's an excitement about this as an opening, which then becomes quite close with thinkers like Sartre.
Right. Thinkers like Nietzsche later is also known for his playfulness. It's an ironic style. Yeah, I think I tried to sketch this in the book a little bit. They say that it's confrontations with nothingness. So there are different approaches to this. So everybody is observing scientific development and then trying to think, what does this mean for me, right? What does this mean for human civilization? Right? Because we can't stick with the old views. Now, something has got to give, right? We have to rethink this. And so what do we end up with? And there are different reactions. And as you say, the one view, which in many ways would be the natural one, is just depression, right? This is morbid. We're all going to die and be destroyed forever. We have no meaning. But then there's this other side as well, which is a response with irony and humor, because if this is true, right, if the picture that the scientific worldview is giving us, the secular world, is true, then this means that all of these things that we invest with value, that they're ultimately, we shouldn't take them that seriously. They're ultimately perishable. They ultimately don't really mean anything. And so this creates a tool, and for many of these thinkers, for social criticism, right? We all know people who take themselves too seriously. They think that their work is the most important thing and that everybody should be respecting them or showing great deference for whatever accomplishments they're proud of. And with this nihilistic disposition, right? It allows us to step back from our that usual value system and to see those things are pretty silly, isn't it? Why is that guy so proud of that? Why am I so proud of this, right? And that maybe we can laugh at ourselves, we can laugh at other people, at society for its hypocrisies and for claiming that, you know, that certain things are important, which are ultimately they're just for show, that they're not really important. Mm-hmm.
But how does the there's sort of a paradox, right, of the Enlightenment, that at the same time it possibly doesn't intend to, but reveals all this, reveals the nothingness beneath everything. But at the same time, it also, coincidentally, it's probably not a coincidence, is, you know, the absolute age of reason and triumph and of, you know, building the biggest and the best of everything, of a sort of, like a human triumphalism of, do you think that was this sort of logocentric, sort of reason-centric grand vision of humanity, now that we are very much in control of reason and these Enlightenment values? Do you think that was an early attempt at overcoming nihilism, of dealing with the very thing that reason revealed?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I see. The way I tried to tell the story in the book is it's a bit the other way around. That I think that the Enlightenment, when it started, its goal wasn't to overcome nihilism. Nihilism wasn't really even perceived as much of a problem, really. But I think for the main Enlightenment thinkers, we're talking here about people like Voltaire, Rousseau, Lessing, Kant. What they were worried about was religious intolerance, persecution, religious wars in Europe, which had been going on for a long time. Mm. That they believe this was just based on things like superstition in religion, religious intolerance. And this was all, of course, in the wake of Martin Luther, the birth of Protestantism. This was just a chaos that was going on. And they thought, all right, we have now human reason, and so we have development in the science. Let's try to apply this to the realm of religion, to get some sanity and to make people more tolerant of people who have different views. We don't have to go to war with one another. I think that was really the goal and the focus of the Enlightenment. I mean, a noble goal, certainly, to try to avoid the suffering that came out of these years and years of religious war and conflict, and to enjoin people to think, okay, well, if we're human, we're rational, we're better than this, right? We can rise above this kind of intolerance. And so I think in that sense, the Enlightenment was a huge step forward with regard to, say, historical development, but it didn't really realize the downside, the other side of it, which only started, say, around the time of the French Revolution, 1789, around the turn of the 19th century, which is where the story in my book starts. If you think the secular worldview all the way to the end, if you really say the scientific picture of the universe is true, and I'm going to stick with that rationality, that reasoning all the way to the end, then suddenly what you end up with, okay, you can maybe get rid of some religious wars, but the picture of human beings, and it looks very different, right? And maybe this is not the place we want to end up, the fact that there's no meaning in the world. We've given up our beliefs in traditional religion. This is potentially a problem that the original Enlightenment thinkers hadn't perceived so clearly when they started, because that they had a different set of goals. It just ended up there later on, once that scientific or secular view began to establish itself.
So, I mean, just to sort of draw on a figure that I've already mentioned, John Paul, right. So would you say, in relation to what you've just said, that, you know, his, as I've sort of stated it here, his death of God, which sort of somewhat differs from, you know, the later more famous Nietzschean death of God, you see that almost as a side effect, and it's not some explicit thing that was written. It's like, well, if we're going to follow this trajectory, well, this is very much a reality that happens actually as a side effect and not as a as an explicit statement.
I think that John Paul is really a perfect critic to exactly this development, because he realized that, and he, like many of the scientists of the day, I mean, he himself, we think of him as primarily a literary figure, but he also was very familiar with the science of his day, and he wanted to be a progressive scientist as well. But then there's this other side. I don't want to give up my values. I don't want to give up the meaning in my life, right? Even though I want to pursue this. And so I think, John Paul, and then that the one text that I treat, the dead Christ proclaims that there is no God. If people don't know that text, I can only recommend it. Read it yourself. My description of it in the book, or even here, it doesn't do it justice at all. You say John Paul is such a brilliant writer. Mm-hmm. The images that he invokes there are so powerful. It's a text you can't forget after you read it. It really, I think, makes an impression on people. And the idea that that we have kind of a second coming, Christ comes down from the heavens and presents himself, and the dead souls come out of their graves in anticipation of, okay, now this is the second coming, we're going to be judged and saved. But then Christ says, there is no God. I've been everywhere in the universe, and God doesn't exist. And then the dead souls just are annihilated. They disappear into nothingness. It's a horrific vision that he presents there. It's really, really powerful descriptions of the situation. And I think his point is, okay, you disabused Enlightenment scientist, you think this is so easy to sit back and say God doesn't exist, immortality doesn't exist. Okay, look at this picture and say that again. Could you really accept that, right? And I think in this sense, the images that he presents, the literary approach, it's far more powerful as an argument than a philosophical one, right? I mean, you could sit back and give arguments to try to refute this, but John Paul just gives us a picture, right? He gives us this image and says, can you really accept a world that looks like that? You're saying maybe from a theoretical point of view, this all sounds easy enough. Say we're all nihilists and move on. But let's look at this concretely here. Could you really accept a world in which that looks like this, where we're all going to die and be annihilated? There's no salvation. There's no consolation. There's no meaning. There's nothing here. And that's a much more difficult thing to accept at the practical level than just to say it theoretically, as if it's a simple matter of mathematics or something, because it's not.
do you think as in a way this is the big, well, not in a way, it is, your book is about the beginnings of nihilism, and I would say that today we're still dealing somewhat with the hangover of this, or still trying to deal with it. With regard to John Paul's sort of image, this picture, no salvation, you die, you're annihilated, that's it. No meaning. Do you feel we have made any steps towards dealing with it as in a social sense?
I think our disposition towards this sort of thing today is a little bit different. For me, the 19th century is so interesting, and why it emerges as a problem here has to do, as I say, with this development of science, which changed from the religious worldview to a secular worldview. Now, since that time, into our own times, science has only been growing and developing even more quickly, right? I mean, even in our own lifetime, science has really reached an amazing tempo, right? It's difficult to, even for very educated people, to keep up with everything in the different fields. And so I think we've all become, I mean, now we live and born into secular societies. We're much more comfortable with that scientific worldview than the people of John Paul's generation were. And so when new scientific developments or discoveries come up, look, the Hubble telescope, they discovered some new galaxies or something. Okay, that's really interesting, but it doesn't lead me to great depression, right? I mean, these kind of scientific discoveries happen all the time, and we try to inform ourselves about them, and we learn about them, but we don't have this existential crisis that people in the 19th century had in the same way, just because we're used to the scientific development. But you're right to say that the problem is still there. I mean, as individuals, we are still asking, what should my values be? Is what I'm doing valuable or important? And I think that fundamental need to believe that what you're doing in your life has some value somehow, it's just as much today. That's a human need, right? And we still struggle with that today. And I think, when we look around to our modern societies, we can see people, this, maybe especially young people, they really struggle with this as they try to find themselves and figure out what they want to do with their lives. There's no easy answers anymore. No.
Certainly isn't. I guess to draw on a sort of a philosophical point, and maybe point out the differences in between 19th and 20th century. What do you see as the key difference? Because to go back to John Paul, this death of God, this almost literary admittance, or as you call it, like a picture.
Right.
What do you see as the difference between John Paul's death of God, if you think I'm correct in phrasing it that way, and Nietzsche's death of God?
Yeah, that's also a good example of the two completely contrasting approaches that are due to the fact that gradually by Nietzsche's time, also science was establishing itself more and more. And so he was not nearly as shocked about this as what somebody in John Paul's generation was. So for Nietzsche, of course, his idea of the death of God is, it's ultimately something liberating and empowering, right? Because Nietzsche believes that in the traditional Christian worldview of things, that this is a very repressive view, where the mediocre people drag down these great spirits and prevent them from truly developing what he calls their will to power, right? Tries to stop them from expressing what he thinks is like their natural drive to fulfillment and to flourishing that we all have. But no, in Christianity, we're all taught, we shouldn't do that. We should all have a guilty conscience if we do that. And so we create these psychological mechanisms where we actually repress ourselves unknowingly, even if the masses are not there to repress us individually. And so for Nietzsche, this is a good thing. Let's just get rid of all these hang-ups and guilty conscience and things like that. And of course, it's not going to be for everybody. There's still going to be a vast majority of mediocre or stupid people for Nietzsche, right? But there will be those few great spirits who will be able to affirm themselves and their own will to power, their own lives, and create their own value system. And so for him, ultimately, this is a good thing. This is a real return to true human nature, whereas the Christian worldview has distorted human nature and has prevented us from reaching our great potential. And so in a way, it's quite the opposite of John Paul. John Paul says, I'll paint you a picture, and it's a horrible one. We don't want to go there, right? Whereas Nietzsche said, look, this might be horrible for those people who are weak and stupid and average, but this is actually a good thing in the big picture for humanity as a whole, because these great spirits will arise, which will help humanity to progress forward. This is, of course, a picture that John Paul could never accept. And Nietzsche, for his part, he would accuse John Paul of being in bad faith, being in self-deception. Oh, okay, you can't accept this picture, but I mean, that's not a refutation of the science, right? Mm-hmm. Just because you can't live with the fact you're not immortal, that's not an argument for the fact that you are immortal.
immortal. So you say on page 76, and this was a really interesting undercurrent throughout many of the thinkers that you tackle. They want to be immortal like God, but would only be bored with it. Mortality is thus necessary. And so even though it seems you know, part and parcel with the death of God, with this understanding of our inherent limitations as human beings. One of the specific factors that, that is brought to the surface is mortality. Is but the way you describe it, it makes it into so much more than just, you know, we're going to die. It's a it's a very it's kind of morbid, but it's just very, very blunt. But mortality plays this very key role. Like this notion that you said, you know, when we can no longer be gods, we no longer have this privileged place. So, yeah, how are we reacting to mortality in the 19th century?
Yeah, I think that this is definitely one of the big shocking moments where, you know, the science, the secular worldview tells you, look, that there's no scientific basis to believe you're immortal. Right? You are a part of the animal kingdom. Your whole being is developed from animals, right? And like animals, you will die. You are finite and mortal. Right? You're everything that we know about your consciousness, your personality, your life experiences, it comes from your brain. When you die, your brain dies. Everything about you as a person is gone at that point. And that's a difficult thing to accept. I mean, it makes people uncomfortable even today to talk about that, to talk about their own mortality, their own death. And this is, I think, one of the deepest sources of human anxiety. I think one of the people's greatest fear is death, no matter what culture you live in. In historically, this is always something that I think people have in the back of their minds. And so people like John Paul, that they want to hold on to that at any cost, even if it's contradicted by what the science says. Well, I can't demonstrate this to you rationally. I certainly can't demonstrate it to you through science, but this has to be the case because the alternative is just so terrible. I can't even think it, right? Or I couldn't live my life based on it. So that's where it comes down. Well, is that a plausible position to have, or is that self-deception?
Do you feel, even though now we would, you know, as we've said, that we live primarily in the West within a secular culture, even though we apparently do and we appear to accept that when we die, you know, we'll just be annihilated, that we are mortal, do you still see us perhaps living otherwise, that, you know, that's still kept at bay, we there's some other illusion, or maybe it's just apathy, you know, we just, I'll ignore that until it's there?
Well, I don't think it's apathy. I mean, I think everybody personally has a huge interest in it because it's my death. I might be apathetic towards the death of other people, but for me, I can't afford to be apathetic about it. I can avoid thinking about it. And I think that's what most people do. I mean, in our day-to-day lives, we're busy, right? We've got many obligations. We can't constantly be sitting there meditating on our own death all the time. That's probably a good thing, right? that would not be a great way to live your life either. But I think if we want to put this in the modern context, from a sociological perspective, you can still see what a problem this is in the sense that it's not just our death will be annihilated, but that also that our whole existence will be forgotten, right? That it's like we'd never existed. We just don't matter. And there is this fundamental human need to be recognized by other people as important and valuable. And you see this in the ancient world, right? The Egyptian pharaohs, they made these huge, huge funeral monuments for themselves, right? In order to make the statement to the world, I lived here and I'm important. Right? So recognize this. So with this massive pyramid, it's difficult to look at that and not reach that conclusion. Whoever did this must have been an extremely important person in his time. And in the modern world, this comes out in, of course, nobody's building pyramids anymore, but it comes out in many different ways. If you think of the huge attraction of social media. What are people doing in social media, right? They're trying to draw attention to themselves in order to get recognition, right? They're trying to present a picture to themselves, of themselves to the outside world that is presumably a favorable portrayal of who they are and their accomplishments or their intelligence or their beauty, whatever it is about themselves as people that they're proud of. And in a certain sense, that's like building your own private pyramid, isn't it? It's trying to tell the world I'm important, right? And when other people read or see what I'm doing on social media, they confirm my own sense that I'm important because I have so many likes or smileys or whatever, followers. And so there's a dialectical interaction here where I want to gain that recognition from other people, so I believe myself that my life is important. Other people give me that recognition, and so I feel confirmed, right? I'm much happier if I feel like there are many people out there in the world that I'm half famous or something like that, that I really have established that my life is valuable and meaningful.
So I guess, in relation to, into the term nihil, nothing, it is, mortality, as we're talking about, isn't really death. That's a tiny part of it. Right. The real horror of mortality is being forgotten, is nothing. Like, it's almost like death and nothingness are kind of different, right? Death is probably seen maybe as this, this horrible, possibly painful act where you're in hospital, but it's the nothing. It's the all my experience, everything is gone. Yeah. I mean, it's an intriguing, in the abstract, mortality is so much more.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right. Of course, we're all disturbed about our own death, right? That is, of course, it's going to be painful, probably, it's not a pleasant experience. But you see, it's that extra thing about being forgotten that bothers us maybe even a bit more, right? Because, all right, we all are experiencing some pain now and again, and hopefully, when death comes, maybe it will be quick and more or less painless. But the fact that one day I'm going to be completely forgotten. There's not going to be anybody left who even remembers me or knows about me. That's a difficult thing to accept. And what was the meaning of my life? Well, what was I even doing here in existence? And what was my mission on this planet? When you think of all the sweat, the toil, the tears that you cried in your life, in order to do something, and to think none of it matters. Everything you've ever invested some value in, some meaning in, it doesn't matter at all in the big picture. I think that's very difficult for people to accept, and pretty much impossible for anybody to live with as a way of life.
You seem to have accepted it, though. You're smiling and laughing about it. Do you mind if I ask? You seem to have taken this with quite a lot of humor. Does it bother you as someone who's spent so long studying nihilism and mortality?
It doesn't bother. I don't have any problem having conversations like that. I don't feel uncomfortable about it. I think actually it's a good thing if people can speak openly about these sorts of issues or about issues of religion, which I think many people would regard as a little bit sensitive. But I think this issue is misplaced a little bit. The way in which the question is formed is misplaced, and this does also go back to the 19th century. Right? If we move from a religious worldview to a secular worldview, of course that's going to be a shock to people, right? To digest that change in values. But now, as you say, we live in a scientific worldview right from the start, right? We live in a secular society, and maybe we're posing the question wrong, because we have some expectation that out there in this grand universe, which is so big, is so old, we can't even imagine it. I mean, why would we have any expectation that we as individuals would play any kind of a meaningful role there, right? It seems like it's an unreasonable expectation. Why would I have to demand that of the universe? It doesn't make any sense. And even the universe itself, what are we talking about here? The universe itself is not a self-conscious agent which is looking down on itself, the universe, and deciding, okay, that planet over there is important, this one over here isn't, or there's this tiny life form over here which is important. That's absurd. It doesn't make any that picture doesn't make any sense at all. And so when we're talking about value and meaning, it's only human beings who have value in meaning, who create that for themselves. And so if that's true, then I'm at my liberty to choose my own values and to regard my life as meaningful as best I can. And if other people have other values, that's okay. That's normal. Of course, every people are going to have different values, different belief systems, different priorities. Perfectly fine. That's not a threat to me. I mean, I don't need the entire world to agree with my values and my meanings in order to live my life. It's okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting the way you talk about that, because it actually brings me through to the next question. And this from mortality, and the, you know, you said, you know, you've got no problem talking about it. It's a good thing to talk about. This this transition that's happening from the 19th century and beginning in the 19th century that we're talking about, it's almost a mandatory forced honesty for the human race. Okay, you can accept this or not, but this is the way things are. You know, you're a mortal being. And this brings me through to Klingerman and this, you know, this notion of acting. And it seems from that mortality, from all these things we've had to accept from the, we could say, the symptoms of reason and science, you know, it said, well, if we accept this, then guess what? You know, God's kind of dead and everything else is falling apart. And to bring this now down to sort of the social level, Klingerman says the facade starts to, you know, will fall apart as well. So what for him is this facade, and why does he see, I guess, nihilism as breaking it apart?
Yeah, this is also a wonderful text that I really want to recommend strongly to people. It's not really known so well today. People don't read it much. So this is the author, August Klingemann. He was a contemporary of people like Goethe. They lived at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, and wrote this beautiful book, The Night Watches, which tells the story of a kind of a crazy guy who goes out as a night watchman and goes out in the evening and observes human behavior. So he's like an early sociologist, if you will. He observes how people act in the world, and he's very socially critical. And so as a nihilist, he takes the humorous side of nihilism and uses this as a socially critical tool. And Klingemann himself is a theater director, so he's very influenced by dramatic pieces, and so he uses this image of the mask, that we are all out in social life wearing masks because we're playing different roles in society. And I find that a very persuasive or insightful view of social life, because I think it's true. I mean, we all have different kinds of masks because we play different sorts of roles, but that's what makes society function, right? If we didn't have those masks, things would fall apart. If you always spoke your mind every time in certain situations, you'd be in trouble, right? Or people would feel like you're not respecting them correctly, or you're not playing the social role you're supposed to play. And so we all know this intuitively. This is what it means to live in a social world. We negotiate with other people by means of our masks, right? When you go in to teach a class, right? You have students who are playing the role of a student, and you who are playing a role of a teacher, and you see we're all playing a role here, and I respect you in your role as you respect me in my role. But the critical point, which comes out again and again in this text from Klingemann, is that those are just roles, right? You're putting on a facade. He's very good at poking fun at people who really take their roles very, very seriously, right? And say, my role is really important. I'm a leader of society. I have a much higher role in the social hierarchy than you do. And we all know people like this, even though our societies nowadays are not quite so hierarchical as they were back then. Yeah, but it reminds me actually of Sartre in the 20th century is very good at criticizing this sort of a picture, where people have identified 100% with their role. So this is what I am as a human being, right? I am a professor, I'm a lawyer, I'm a doctor, and that, like, I was born one, right? I am that, Sartre's is like a rock is a rock. But what this forgets is, no, there are many contingencies in life that lead you to the social roles that you play. There's nothing absolute about it. If things were different, you could be in a different position playing a different role. And so don't be under the illusion that there is some fixed metaphysical or ontological fact about you as a person associated with a specific role. And so that image of masks, I think it's beautifully done in Klingemann, where you can, it allows his protagonist really to poke fun at people in all different strata of life, where there's always a split between the mask that they want to project and who they really are. And I think that this is a humorous part of nihilism, also an insightful part of it. It can allow you to see through the corruptions, the hypocrisies, and the deceptions of society, which we live in.
For Klingemann, then, who are we? Are we anything?
I think this is also the beautiful part of this, right? You think, all right, once you take off the mask and you go home, right, who are you? There's one model where you think, okay, I am who I am here at home. I can do and say whatever I think. But when I go out there into the world, I need my mask or whatever. But now, even here at home, you're still playing a role, is the argument. You still have a different mask. You still have a mask. It might be a different one than the one you use outside. And so Klingemann uses this image very often. When you remove the mask, what's left? And it's just the skull, right? And so it's death. And so what are you ultimately as a human being? Well, you are a finite natural creature who will one day die and turn into a skeleton. And so behind the mask, there's only the skull. And it's kind of a terrifying image in a certain way, because we all like to believe, well, there is something about me as a person that it is important and valuable. I'm not just that guy who's going to die. And for many of us, we're fortunate enough to be able to do things in life that we like to do, that we identify with. I mean, we really invest some value in that. We want to say that there really is something there. It's not just my mask. I'm not just playing at that. I like doing it, right? This is who I am as a person. And it's a sobering thought that, no, it's just all contingencies of the universe, right? There is no fixed you out there. You could have been a completely different person under different circumstances. And so it's all just different perspective. But if you really want to know who you are, well, you're an animal who's going to die one day. That's all that human essence is. That's a sobering thought.
I mean, I had this extra question from this about what it would be to, you know, not act, as for Klingemann, you know, this is all this masks and acting behind the facade, you know, and I thought, because I'm so fond of him, I thought of someone such as Diogenes, but I guess now actually he's just wearing another cynical mask, right? But, what does he say? At some point he says he's reduced himself to a beast, which is probably as close as you could maybe get to the skull, the sort of Darwinian human still, it's a mask, I guess. But it's an interesting question of whether or not that you know, the move into nihilism and then through into us, you know, more and more so secular and more so having to accept this nihilism which pervades everything, whether or not that actually also means there is more and more honesty. I think I personally see it on a social level that people have generally become a bit more honest, maybe even a bit more blunt. But whether or not that's to do with nihilism, who knows?
I see what you're saying, right? So people have put aside what used to be regarded as certain polite behavior, and they're able to say directly what they think and criticize other people more directly, more openly. That's a good question, where that comes from. Or are we just becoming less concerned about what other people think of us, or more concerned? That's a good question. Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of the humor, as you said with Klingemann, this is the humorous aspect. I mean, what other humor, because this is, you know, as I was saying at the start, I, you know, just found the style and the tone of the 19th century nihilist so different. What other aspects of humor do we see here?
Yeah, I think for me, the best example is probably Klingemann's protagonist, Kreuzgang, so the night watchman who goes out and sees people. His emotional life is very strange. It's one of the things that just makes him different from his society, that he he has these really horrific experiences that he sees people dying and sees the suicide of his friend, the death of his lover in childbirth, and he doesn't seem to feel like the normal human emotions that one would expect somebody to feel in those really extreme situations. He seemed kind of indifferent. He kind of describes it in these things in a neutral tone. But then when he wants to, so there is that kind of grim side to it. Like if science doesn't have any values, it's like it's you who's interpreting them, making them. So it's like he's the scientist just describing objectively what he sees out there in nature, right? Without placing any value on it or normative evaluation. This is good. This is bad. This is terrible. I feel bad about this. None of that. Yeah, but then the humorous aspect is always there at the social level, where he says, yeah, he's got that. I like the one line where he says, he's talking as if to God, right? He says, just leave me laughter my whole life long and I'll hold out here below. So as long as I can laugh at people and their hypocrisies and the absurdities of this life, it's okay. At least life is going to be amusing because of this. And that's the insight of nihilism opens up, that you start to see through the facades of everything, of all traditional customs and practices and roles that people play. And it allows one to criticize society in a different way. And so I find this a kind of a sympathetic approach in many ways. It's a matter of critical self-reflection about oneself and about society. And I think that's a good thing in any case, no matter what your ultimate views are on nihilism or religion. And if this nihilistic insight can help you to that, then I think that's a good thing. As I think very often, as we say, people associate nihilism with like this morbid view, with being depressed or being suicidal. That doesn't have to lead there, right? There's this other side as well that can actually be a sort of a positive humoristic thing.
Well, it doesn't have to lead there, but that does lead to the next question, because you mentioned laughter, and you know, this is the, I guess, for, you know, we'd be jumping forward a bit for Nietzsche as an active nihilist. You know, you take it and use it as an impetus. But one thing that people might say, and I hear this a lot, still in the modern day, but I'll try to relate it back to the 19th century. You know, life is meaningless, but at the same time, I'm going to have a nice dinner later. I'm going to hang out with my friends. Pleasure, right? Pleasure. I mentioned to you modern notions of happiness, which is a bit more tricky, but pleasure, good times, I feel good, etc., etc. Of course, Schopenhauer would completely disagree with this on balance, but laughter as well, I think, comes in there as pleasure. But we also have another figure here, Buchner, who says, well, even pleasure gets negated by nihilism, which is probably seems to be the toughest one to maybe defend, because I think, you know, laughter is not a rational. It's the great thing about laughter. It's not a rational response. It's sort of this spontaneous. Laughter has to be spontaneous, and pleasure, I think, has to be spontaneous. So it's very difficult to sort of argue, I think, that it's going to be negated, that pleasure is going to be negated, because you don't really have a say if my cup of coffee is nice. It's just nice, right? I just enjoy it. So what's Buchner? Why does he think that the pleasure will sort of die away as well?
Yeah, this is a good question. There's Buchner and his drama Danton's Death, which tells the story of Georges Danton, right, the French revolutionary, tells the story leading up to his execution on the guillotine. And the way in which he portrays it, Danton is sort of an Epicurean. He really enjoys the pleasures of life, the food, the drink, and hanging out with his friends, and he makes a case for this. And there's a socially critical aspect to this that Buchner wants to emphasize, that where he tries to make the claim that society generally is just full of crude hypocrites, right? They condemn people who engage in the pleasures of the body, right? But everybody ultimately seeks pleasure, no matter, but people's pleasures are different. Maybe it's hypocritical of some people to criticize those who seek pleasure in, you know, bodily pleasure. They're doing exactly the same thing, but yes, where they find pleasure is something different, maybe in art or whatever, literature, but they're still seeking pleasure. It's the same thing. So it's arbitrary to criticize one form of pleasure seeking and call that lower, and another form of pleasure seeking and call that higher. So there's a socially critical aspect of that. But even so, what's the limitation of that? And here I think he gives us some psychological insights about Danton, where the pleasures that you receive they're finite and passing, right? That's the trick, especially about physical pleasures. They always come back again. You always get hungry again, and your desire is renewed and needs to be satisfied once again. And Danton, in Büchner's portrayal, he's psychologically haunted, right? With old memories. He has these terrible nightmares. And so, seen against that background, it seems like whatever temporary physical pleasures you're going to have, it's a small recompense for the much deeper problem that he has psychologically, and so in that sense, it's clear that the pleasure seeking that's not really any meaningful solution to nihilism in any way. I mean, it's a small amusement, but it doesn't really address the core problem there. And I think yeah, you mentioned Schopenhauer. There's a similar idea in Schopenhauer, where human beings are basically beings who have these constant desires and needs that need to be satisfied, need to be fulfilled to keep us going, and that lack of fulfillment, it's actually a form of suffering. And so those few moments when we're actually able to fulfill our needs, to satisfy our needs, we are satisfied. It doesn't never really last long, and we end up once again trying to struggle to fulfill another need, right? And this is, for Schopenhauer, this is the story of human existence. This is what we're all about. And so we're always suffering, trying to fulfill our needs, and that's kind of a nihilistic picture in that, isn't there? Right? That we never reach a point where, okay, this is the absolute truth. This is the absolute beauty or absolute justice. I've finally reached this point where I'm happy and satisfied. No, never going to be the case. Everything is transitory, changing, mutable. You're always suffering, and then you die, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a positive picture. And I think we can see some similarities in the picture of Danton that Büchner gives. He's struggling and struggling with these deeper existential issues, and never really can get the satisfaction he's looking for.
It's interesting though, you mentioned there's different types of pleasure. You know, someone might be into bodily pleasure, someone might be into whatever, social, maybe political pleasure. Do you feel one could take pleasure in nihilism? Just absolutely give themselves over to the nothingness. I sometimes see this when I read certain authors, just as an aside. You know, I read someone like Emile Cioran, or I guess Nietzsche in a way, at a certain extent. There's a sort of just being absolutely so bowled over by the nothingness that it almost becomes a, I guess, what, like someone like Lacombe or de Jouissance, right? Like a pleasure that's beyond the pleasure principle. It's like almost too much. But could that be an antidote, just to take absolute pleasure in the nothingness? Or do you think that's actually impossible for a human to really do that?
Yeah, maybe it's impossible, but you can do it to certain degrees, I think. I think that really you can see exactly what you're describing in Klingemann, right? In his description of his main character, that you can really see he's having fun with it, right? He's gaining pleasure by making these respectable bourgeois citizens look silly, right? By exposing their hypocrisy and their absurdity. There's a certain satisfaction that one derives from that. And in order to do that, you have to embrace that nihilistic view that, well, I don't really care what they think of me, right, while I'm exposing them, that they're going to get upset and angry with me. They're going to put me in jail or commit me to an asylum. It doesn't matter. I embrace that, but I enjoy exposing other people. I suppose that could be a kind of a pleasure one could get out of it. But then that raises the other question, is that how reasonable is that? How consistent is that? If you're deriving pleasure from that, you think there's something funny or even valuable in exposing people for their hypocrisy. Why? Right? If you're a true nihilist, can you justify that? Is there really a reason for that? Or is it just you're getting a guilty pleasure out of it, or a childish pleasure out of it?
But that does bring us to the question that I moved to the end, as you said, and it makes sense to move it to the end. But I think, so the question, you know, the question is it's almost like the question of philosophy for the last however many years, you know, do you see a means to overcome nihilism? But I think perhaps the better way to phrase that would be, because there are many writers who would have said that they have found a means. You know, Nietzsche, most famously, that's his whole life's work in a way, is to try to overcome nihilism. So it might be better to restrain this to the 19th century and to say, you know, these initial figures who unearthed nihilism or had to deal with it, did any of them, was there a way out in the 19th century? And I guess maybe to make that question a little bit more difficult, was there a way out that didn't just fall back on the things that had been destroyed, right?
Right.
So not faith, not religion, not God, you know. Was there any means to overcome nihilism there?
Yeah, I think what I found interesting and sort of prescient about some of these 19th century attempts, and we've been talking about John Paul, but also in this Danish author that I write about, Paul Martin Muller, the idea that they're not anti-science, right? But they understand fully and appreciate the problem that nihilism is creating. But they just cannot bring themselves to accept that their lives mean nothing, and that they're also very invested in the doctrine of immortality as well. And so, although they're able to concede that it's true, if everything science says is correct, then we're going to die and be annihilated, and that's the end of it. There's no greater meaning or purpose in life. But nonetheless, we still have to believe that in some way or another. We have to say, all right, science doesn't know everything, or there are certain things that can't. I mean, there's no reason to think that in science, but science doesn't rule it out either necessarily. So who knows? Maybe, right? And so there's a need to maybe to widen one's worldview. So today in the modern world, we're used to basing our worldview in large part on science, right? Because that's our main paradigm for what truth is. But there are other things that also play a role in our worldview as well, and that science can't really explain quite so well. And so people like John Paul and Paul Martin Muller, they would argue, well, that this opens up a space for me to believe in what science might regard as something irrational, right? That they're maybe I can make room for these things because I just make a decision that I can't live my life according to that. And it's not quite like the earlier generation. I'm just going to revert back to a religious view. I just reject completely what science says. I just more comfortable believing in my traditional religion and value system. You know, they try to accept the science to a certain degree, but then it's just a denial that, okay, science doesn't have the answers to everything, right? My love for my wife or my children or whatever, I can't. Science can't really explain that in a rational way. And there are certain elements about human life which are inexplicable from a scientific point of view. But nonetheless, I still think they're extremely valuable and they're really important to me and my life. And so, that might. That approach seems to me an interesting one. I'm not necessarily certain I want to go along with it myself, but the idea that one needs a worldview that hangs together. One can't have a worldview where you have different beliefs and constantly in contradiction with one another, and that science can fulfill a large part of it, but there's also going to be these other spheres where you need to fill it in with other things, and you hope those other things are not inconsistent with science.
How have you overcome nihilism? What? Philosophy?
I don't know. I think just where nihilism has helped me is just to try to put a perspective on my own life and my own work and my own relationships to other people. For me, these are things which are, of course, supremely important. They're really valuable to me. Right? Mm-hmm. I have a certain number of years or days or hours to live, and I want to make use of that time doing things which are important to me, right? And this is a valuable perspective to have, right? And I want to be as absolutely honest with myself as I possibly can. I don't want to lie to myself or create certain fictions just because I want them to be true, or it would be nice if they were. I think that always leads to sort of a split in one's head that is going to come out sooner or later in one way anyway. And I don't know, we all struggle with these things. I don't think I'm any different than anyone else here, but I try to be as honest with myself about these things as I can, and try to believe that the value system I create for myself is, I can defend, or at least I have some good reasons for it. And yeah, to see that in perspective, that the world, the universe doesn't owe me anything. It has no values. I've been created as a natural product of it. And I have this opportunity, but it would be silly of me to go and demand that the universe put me in the center and make something really super important about me as an individual. That's a completely absurd expectation, I think.
Is there anything you'd like to add about your book that you feel is key that we haven't touched upon?
Yeah, but I can only thank you for having me here for this discussion. I'm really glad that I think the book fits nicely with your podcast, and that was really my goal to try to focus on some of these thinkers who are not really so well known today, and in my opinion have been underestimated a bit, and that especially coming from my field, philosophy, I know that in philosophy and universities, when people teach courses on something like that, they never read these authors. I find that a bit of a shame. They're so insightful, but the philosophers, they want to read just a purely philosophical treatise. Okay, here's my thesis, here's five arguments for that. But they miss the point that for an issue like this, often a literary text or a dramatic piece, a poem, is far more powerful and persuasive than a philosophical argument. And I really think that's an important message that I try to get across with the book, that the even though there might be authors working in different genres that we don't associate with philosophy, they're working with the same philosophical topics that the philosophers today are working with. And mm-hmm. Why not add them to that discussion?
Absolutely. So what are you working on now? Another book on nihilism?
Yeah. Well, I'm working on another book on on religion, trying to understand why human beings throughout history have understood the gods in such different ways. Why is it that some religions and cultures, they imagine the gods to be like a jaguar or a crocodile or a natural object, a stone or a tree, a river? And what is a little bit like the nihilism book, where I want to see the logic of the development of the idea. Where do those ideas start? Why on earth would anyone want to think that a tree is a god or a river is a god? What situation, what context would make that seem a plausible idea? These are the questions I'm really interested in finding answers to.
That sounds fascinating. I'd love to talk to you about it when it's released. Is that a way off?
Maybe a year off. I've been working on it for some time. I find it fascinating. I really love the topic. I've learned a lot from it.
I'd love to talk to you about that. But as per the book on nihilism, History of Nihilism in the 19th Century, I'll put the links in the description below for people who want to purchase it. But otherwise, I feel like that's a good place to finish up. So, John Stewart, thanks very much.
Great. Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.